around it. And once you do get around it, no problems as you head towards the lower deck of the Bay Bridge. The other problems in San Jose, southbound 101 at Julian Street. This is a two-car crash. It is off to the right shoulder. I'm Joe Salvatore for KQED.
All right, see you next hour. Thanks, Joe. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health, whose partnership with Sonoma Valley Hospital means UCSF patients in the North Bay can access the hospital's new 3T MRI, featuring a shorter, more comfortable scan with faster results. Appointments available now. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car to KQED is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not in most cases, and invest the funds back into our news coverage. You can learn more at kqed.org/cars. I'm Sandy Altouse. Good evening. This is KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento, 8 o'clock.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. During the early white-hot months of his administration, Donald Trump instituted a new policy to separate families detained at the U.S. border. Protests erupted, declaring it cruel and un-American. But the policy of immigrant detention in the U.S. is far from new. It's been used on Jews fleeing Nazi Germany, migrants from civil wars in Central America, and immigrants from around the world since the policy was codified in 1891. Stanford professor Ana Raquel Mignon will take us through this history, which is the subject of her new book, In the Shadow of Liberty. She's coming up next after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. The prosecution has rested its case in the criminal fraud trial of former President Donald Trump. The judge admonished the first defense witness, who's a former legal advisor to key prosecution witness Michael Cohen. Outside of the courthouse, Trump said it was past time for Judge Merchan to throw out the case.
A great judge just says, where exactly is the crime? To quote a memorable line from Shakespeare in Love, I don't know, it's a mystery. There is just no crime.
Trump is charged with 34 criminal counts of falsifying business records, a felony in New York State. Closing arguments are set to begin next week. President Biden is blasting the International Criminal Court for considering an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu. The Israeli prime minister and leaders of Hamas are charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity over the war in Gaza. But Biden says the ICC is wrong to accuse Netanyahu.
We reject the ICC's application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
Biden speaking at a White House reception honoring Jewish American Heritage Month. In Tel Aviv, NPR's Daniel Estrin has reactions to the ICC effort from Israel and from Hamas leaders.
Israeli President Isaac Herzog called the prosecutor's decision beyond outrageous by drawing parallels between Hamas's attack October 7th and Israel's response. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz issued a video. He says he'll ask leading countries to promise they will not enforce any potential arrest warrants. Hamas official Ghazi Hamad. He said people under occupation have the right to armed resistance. Hebrew University professor of international law, Yuval Shani, called it a dramatic development which could hamper officials' ability to travel.
Putin, who's facing a similar predicament, he is a persona non grata in most areas of the world, and this could also happen to Netanyahu.
He says the court could rule on arrest warrants in days or weeks. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Cleanup continues in parts of Texas following a deadly storm last Thursday. From Houston Public Media, Lucio Vasquez has the latest.
Trees and debris are still being cleared from Houston roadways after last week's storm, which brought winds of up to 100 miles per hour. Areas of downtown were closed off as workers began repairing blown-out windows. Officials have warned that it could take weeks to get power restored for everyone in the region. Additionally, an injured cement worker has filed a lawsuit against his employer after extreme winds caused a crane to collapse on top of him. Local authorities believe at least 8 deaths may be connected to the storm. I'm Lucio Vasquez in Houston.
On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed. You're listening to NPR News. The container ship that crashed into Baltimore's Key Bridge has been torn down. The dolly lost power twice before slamming into the span in March, causing it to collapse into a river. A series of controlled explosions helped crews clear the largest remaining section of the span a week ago. The Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed on March 26, killing six workers and halting port traffic in Baltimore. ChatGPT maker OpenAI says it's pulling an AI voice assistant that was compared to actress Scarlett Johansson. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the company says that artificial intelligence voices should not mimic celebrities.
When OpenAI did a live demo of its new ChatGPT voice assistant, many noted it sounded a lot like Scarlett Johansson from the 2013 sci-fi movie Her. Here it is interpreting the emotions of an OpenAI employee.
It looks like you're feeling pretty happy and cheerful, with a big smile and maybe even a touch of excitement. Whatever's going on, it seems like you're in a great mood. Care to share the source of those good vibes?
OpenAI is now pulling the voice. The company says it was developed from an actress who is not Scarlett Johansson, but that AI shouldn't copy a celebrity's distinctive voice. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman tweeted out the word her on the day of the product's release. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Former stock trader Ivan Boesky has died at the age of 87. Boesky spent 2 years of a three-year sentence in jail and paid a record $100 million fine after pleading guilty to insider trading in the mid-1980s. He was part of the inspiration for the character Gordon Gekko in the 1987 film Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Never miss a headline. KQED's social media channels bring you news updates in real time. Real time tonight, temperatures in the upper 40s to low 50s, and tomorrow, another sunny day and a little bit warmer, too. Highs from the low 60s to the mid-80s. 83 for Livermore's high tomorrow, same for San Jose. 72 expected in San Francisco. It's 8:06.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. The American immigration system did not develop in some rational way. Instead, government officials and judges in the last 150 years have made a series of decisions that have led to some Byzantine and seemingly un-American situations. Ana Raquel Mignon's new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, zooms in on the legal and political infrastructure of one piece of that system, the way that some immigrants are detained. In some cases, would-be migrants to the United States are held without constitutional rights for an indeterminate length of time inside what amount to prisons, though they've done nothing against our laws. Mignon's book is both a history of and an argument against the practice. She's an associate professor of history at Stanford, and she joins us this morning here at the studio. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. You know, so the phrase immigrant detention might seem self-explanatory, but it is kind of a specific thing within our system. How do you define it, and what makes it so specific to the American system?
Well, other countries also have immigrant detention. Immigrant detention is the idea that it's a place to hold immigrants, and they very much function like prisons, mm-hmm. but their purpose is supposedly very different. So the idea is that we're holding migrants while we decide as a country whether we can accept them in or whether they need to be deported and that deportation takes place. So it's not a prison to hold people who have been accused of breaking the law.
Mm-hmm. And one of the strange things about it is even if people are held on U.S. soil, they don't actually enjoy the rights of our Constitution, even though they're in the United States.
That's right. That's part of what I show in the book is that in 1891, when immigration detention was first ruled to be possible by Congress. Congress introduced this law, which we now have come to understand and call the entry fiction, whereby immigrants who first arrived, who were just arriving to the United States, could be held on land, could be detained anywhere in the United States, and yet legally we would imagine as if they were not here, as if they were outside. And because they were not here, they didn't deserve basic constitutional rights. So some detained migrants do have rights. For example, if someone is apprehended in Los Angeles after having lived there, they are an undocumented migrant. This migrant is assumed to be in the United States, and so he holds rights. In contrast, an immigrant who is just arriving, crossing the border, is apprehended then, and then is, for example, detained in Louisiana, deep in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. This person has very limited constitutional rights because they are assumed not to be here.
How big is the group of people who are detained in this way, you know, not on U.S. soil, but on U.S. soil through the entry fiction?
Finding numbers for detained immigrants is particularly hard because the government doesn't reveal how different immigrants are being held. At the same time, during many, many years in our history, it had different counting methods. It undercounted. Sometimes it even overcounted. Who counted is very different. But what we do know is that since 1941, over 14 million immigrants have been detained in our immigrant detention system. And that those numbers increased dramatically during the Obama administration, then during the Trump administration. And the number of detainees has decreased with Biden, but primarily because of the pandemic, and has since then continued to rise.
You know, one of the things that I found really interesting is to reflect on when you do not have constitutional rights, what do you not have, right? Like we know that our prison system in general is not a great place and people don't feel like they have all the rights. But these particular immigrants who are detained in this way, what are the things that they don't have, right? I mean, like, for example, it seems like they don't know when they're going to get out. There's no set marker or date, right? They're just being held for an indeterminate length of time.
That's right. One of the main things they don't have is the right to due process. So they can be held without having been accused of a crime. So they are being caged without having been accused of a crime. They don't have the right to trial, so they can never defend themselves. I mean, they don't know what they're being accused often, right. So they can't, or are not accused of anything, and yet they can't defend themselves in trial. And at the same time, like you said, they're not told when they're going to be released or even if they're going to be released. So it is a very dire situation to not have these basic constitutional rights.
So what are the roots of this policy, this entry fiction? I mean, why 1891? Like, what's significant about that period?
So up until then, immigrants in 1882, let me start a little bit earlier.
Yeah,
in 1882, we had the Chinese Exclusion Act, which said, you know what? Chinese people cannot come into the United States. There's only a very limited number of Chinese people who can arrive. For example, students, merchants, but the vast majority of Chinese people cannot come.
Driven largely by racism out here on the West Coast, right?
In California, particularly, there was a lot of xenophobia. Chinese people were accused of taking jobs away from American citizens. Soon after this law passed in 1882, other laws passed that prohibited other groups of people from coming. So, for example, people who were accused of potentially being quote unquote lunatics, or would take jobs away from, not take jobs, but use the welfare of American citizens, become a public charge. So after 1882, as vessels started to arrive to the United States with people who wanted to arrive, to come in, immigration officials needed to decide, well, are these folks Chinese laborers who are not allowed to come in? Are they potential lunatics who are not allowed to go in? So they would go onto the vessels and try to determine, does this person deserve entrance? Does this other person deserve entrance? The problem is, this often took a long time. And sometimes these immigrants would appeal and say, no, actually, I was a U.S.-born citizen, even though, like, you assume I'm Chinese, I'm a U.S.-born citizen, I have the right to enter the United States. So these cases would take months. And finally, these ship
with the people just sitting on the ship during this whole time. The ship can't leave, can't continue on its route, none of that stuff. They're just sitting in the port.
That's right. So the ship companies were like, we need to leave. We need our vessels to be able to come and go. And so in 1891, Congress says, okay, you can detain people on land, but you can only do so if we imagine that they're still on the vessels. And that's how the century fiction starts, is saying like, oh, no, they're not really here. They're still on the vessels. They haven't entered. They don't have our rights. The following year, Ellis Island opens as the first immigrant detention center in our country.
And it's interesting. I mean, the immigrant detention center that I'm most familiar with is here on Angel Island, was here on Angel Island. How did that one develop?
So before Angel Island, there was one in San Francisco right here that was owned by one of these vessel companies, the Pacific Mail Company, that, you know, had one of these vessels or many of these vessels that needed to come and go. And so they decided to use one of their sheds to detain immigrants. Right. And, you know, this shed was absolutely horrid. It packed hundreds of people. It was overcrowded by over 300% at some times. There were no windows, or there were only six windows. They had mesh. It was dirty. People had to sit on the floor to eat. There were no tables. There were no chairs. It was a fire hazard. And as people started to complain, and as, you know, the government wanted to incarcerate more people, they decided that, okay, the shed is not working. Let's create something that makes it, A, harder for Chinese immigrants to escape, and B, that can have the semblance of being more humane, especially because we can, you know, set it apart from potential, you know, reporters who go there or family members who are trying to see what's happened. So they decided to follow the example of Ellis Island to put it away from the mainland. Mm. And in 1910, they opened Angel Island, which of course also had absolutely brutal conditions.
Yeah. You know, I think many Americans who have ancestors who went through Ellis Island when they, you know, first arrived in the United States have kind of seen it as, you know, the gateway to America. And it's like this, you know, rose-colored historical glasses. But you don't necessarily see it that way, or at least not only that way.
That's correct. In the United States, we interpret Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty, as this place, you know, where the poor huddled masses have come in and been welcomed into this country. And yet, Ellis Island also functioned as a prison. Mm. For about 15% of all immigrants who came, they were caged for a while, some for short periods of time, many for months. Ellis Island is not known in this way as a prison, but for many, many thousands of immigrants, it did function in such ways.
And when we say prison, I mean, all of the restrictions of prison that we're kind of imagining are in play here, right? I mean, even if it's not called a prison.
That's correct. Immigrants interpret it as a prison. The facilities are very much function as a prison. The officials who are crafting these detention centers take their example from prisons and sort of are informed by prison ideology at the time. And as time goes by, the relationship between prisons and immigrant detention centers only increases. At first, when Chinese immigrants were arriving, for example, and there were very few, you know, the shed was totally overcrowded, people were held in jails. So from the beginning, the penal system is used for detention centers. And as time goes by, this increases and increases to the point that many immigrants arrive, have committed no crimes again. But, you know, while we determine what to do with them, we held them in maximum security penitentiaries. Similarly, the detention system has informed the prison system. For example, in the 1980s, the Reagan administration said that it had to build more prisons, not only for the war on drugs, but also to hold all of these immigrants that were being held in prisons.
We're talking with Stanford history professor Ana Raquel Mignon about her book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. We'll be back with more right after the break.
Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Humane, announcing its 10th annual Pints for Paws Beer Festival with over 50 vendors on Saturday, June 1st, dedicated to shelter animals in need of urgent medical care. BerkeleyHumane.org. Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi with Xfinity Gateway and XFi Pod that extends coverage to hard-to-reach areas. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
I'm Mina Kim. On Forum's 9 p.m. rebroadcast, Tessa Roseboom has been studying the long-term health impacts of starvation on Dutch survivors of a German blockade of food imports during World War II. Her research has sobering relevance for those living through today's conflicts and their descendants. We talk about actions we can take tonight at 9 here on KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Stanford history professor Ana Raquel Mignon about her new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States, kind of a prehistory of the family separation policies that occurred at the border during the Trump administration. We'd love to hear from you. Have you or a loved one had experience in the immigration detention system? Or has your work brought you into contact with the system? Perhaps you're a lawyer or an advocate. You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. The email address is forum@kqed.org. We actually, one of our listeners, Michael, tweets, "My great-great uncle was briefly detained at Ellis Island on suspicion that he was a contract laborer. When they let him go, he took a train to Chicago, got a job at U.S. Steel." Want to talk about the kind of changes. You know, your book kind of periodizes this, the immigration detention system. You know, we've got the 1891, you know, all of the kind of legal infrastructure kind of comes into play, and it's used through that whole time. And there's a celebrated case of a woman, Ellen Knopf, who was a German, Jewish, and Czech woman who was a kind of World War II bride of an American GI, Kurt Knopf. What happened to her, and why did her case become so significant?
So her case is pretty tragic. She was born in Germany to a Jewish family right before the Second World War. Hitler comes to power. She manages to escape to the Czech Republic. So she's escaped. But her parents, her siblings, they're all killed. After the war, she goes back to Germany to find out what happened to her family, and she realizes that they had all been killed. So she joins the U.S. Army in occupation in Germany. So she started to support, to even work for the U.S. Army. There, she meets a man who she falls in love with, and he was an American GI. So he had the right to bring her to the United States very, very easily through the GI Bill, War Rights Bill. So she comes in 1948. She's traveling in the USS Comfort to America thinking, you know, oh, I'm going to see the Statue of Liberty, ta-ra. But instead, as soon as she arrives, she is sent to Ellis Island and detained there. Ellen was very good at promoting her case. She had lived in many countries. She had a very tragic story. And so the media immediately grabbed onto it. And meanwhile, the attorney general didn't tell her why she was being held in Ellis Island, for how long, what she could do about it.
They didn't have to. Like, legally, they didn't have to do anything.
Because of the entry fiction, that's correct. Right. So she didn't have a right to a hearing. But the media took her case, and eventually she did get a Supreme Court case. Now, in the Supreme Court, she was not fighting for the right to enter the country. What she was fighting for is for the right to have a hearing, you know, to be said, why am I being detained? And she actually lost that Supreme Court case. And it's a very important Supreme Court case that continues to rule and to say, yes, look, we can still detain immigrants without rights if we hold them as soon as they arrive. But on the other hand, the attention that Ellen's case received meant that the attorney general finally released her. And because there was so much anger about her case, the attorney general decided, look,
We have seen from our past that detention is not necessary. It's not giving us anything. Immigrants are still entering the country, the vast majority of them. It's just bringing us negative publicity. There's no reason to detain them. So in 1954, the Attorney General announces to the public, we are no longer going to detain immigrants. Instead, we're going to release the vast majority on parole, and we're only going to hold those who are likely to abscond or who pose a danger to U.S. society. From 1954 until 1980, government officials spoke fervently against immigrant detention. And in fact, I think that the Supreme Court case that you were referring to occurred in 1958, where the Supreme Court looked at how detention had changed and said that certainly this policy reflects the humane qualities of an enlightened civilization. So enlightenment then was moving against detention.
Although there is one kind of crucial exception, right, which is the treatment of Mexican Americans here in California.
That's right. Mexican immigrants were treated differently than the vast majority of immigrants who arrived at that time. They were considered an exception because as soon as they arrived, they were not considered to be deportable. So if an undocumented migrant arrived and was apprehended by immigration officials, this migrant was told, okay, do you want to be deported? Or we can give you this other thing called voluntary departure. And it allows us to never detain you and to send you back to Mexico immediately. So, of course, all immigrants were like, yeah, don't detain me. Send me back to Mexico. And so they were held for very short periods of time in similar to detention centers, but in places until the government simply threw them back across the border. And it called these sort of not detention centers. It didn't think of them as detention centers, but more as stopping gaps, launching pads to return them back home.
But also, there were multiple other things happening right with the immigration system, such that there were large numbers of Mexican immigrants who were here, or at least Mexican migrants, perhaps not people who are going to stay forever, but in the Bracero like work program. But they're also being deported in large numbers through a process that was called Operation Wetback, one of the infamous American operations carried out against Mexican migrants. I mean, did those things end up informing this immigrant detention system as well, or were they kind of a parallel track in history?
Well, it's really interesting because this operation that you speak about, Operation Wetback, occurred in 1954, the same year that the Attorney General announced that he was moving away from detention, from immigrant detention. So they really occur in parallel ways. They're not Mexican immigrants were not really seen as immigrants. They were not seen as a rival. They were seen more as birds of passage. And in fact, you mentioned the Bracero program. The Bracero program was a program whereby Mexican migrants could come for short periods of time, work in the United States, and then return to Mexico, all legally. It ends in 1964, and after that, Mexican migrants continue coming, now much more without papers, but it's still circular migration. They come to the United States for short periods of time, and then they return back home, only to then come back to the United States. But so they were seen as a very different type of immigrants than other immigrants, and they were really the image of the illegal alien, you know, during this period, that's when it really develops, like Mexicans are illegal aliens. And so detention was thought of for them as very different than for the vast majority or for the other immigrants who were coming. And it was primarily because they were not deported. They were offered voluntary departure. Just the vast numbers of people, of Mexicans who were coming, didn't allow the government to ever detain them. That's why they were thought of as different.
We're talking with Stanford history professor Ana Raquel Mignon about her book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. We'd love to hear from you. Have you or a loved one had experience in this immigration detention system? You know, has your work brought you in contact with it? You can give us a call. Number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. One of the things that I really loved about this book was the way that it seemed to make the world make a little bit more sense. Because you encounter the immigration system as it is and you think like, God, like how did all this stuff happen? It feels so absurd at some level. One of the episodes of history that I knew the least about that seemed to have quite an impact is this Mariel Boatlift of Cuban people into the United States, and then all the kind of like repercussions of having this like big burst of immigrants from Cuba into the United States at this very particular time. What happened with that boat lift for those who don't remember or aren't familiar with it, and what was its impact on this immigrant detention system?
So Fidel Castro in Cuba prohibited the vast majority of Cubans from leaving the country. In 1980, there's a lot of protests in Cuba, and he announces, okay, everyone who wants to leave the country can do so, and they have to do so through the port of Mariel. So this is what comes to be known as the Mariel Boatlift. In the summer of 1980, over 124,000 Cubans sailed from the port of Mariel to the United States. Now, as they were on these...
Which is a crazy story in and of itself if you go look it up and you start to look into it. But anyway, go ahead.
Absolutely. It's like people taking embassies and people dying in the water as they head out. But anyway, as they're sailing to the United States, to the Florida Straits, Castro tells the United States, you know what? We opened up our prisons and many of the people who are arriving are convicts and are criminals who are dangerous. So, of course, many Americans.
Was that true, first of all?
Proportionally, it was very, very few people. Mm. But it brings sort of fear upon everyone who's arriving. Mm-hmm. It was true, but it really wasn't something that was a big deal. But as they're arriving, Americans become extremely concerned. And before they set sail, President Carter had announced, we're going to receive these immigrants with open arms. Afterwards, it was like, oh, we're definitely not receiving them with open arms. First, he opens naval bases across the country to detain migrants while the government decides, okay, yes, this person is not a criminal. They can come in. But the Mariel Boatlift causes, like I said, much fear about future immigration. It feels to many Americans that Castro sort of pulled one on the American government. And the American government is like, we are not going to allow this to ever happen again. So if we remember Allen's case, after Allen in 1954, the government had turned away from immigrant detention. The Supreme Court had said that immigrant detention, moving away from it, was what an enlightened civilization did. After 1980, the government moved away from this enlightenment and decided we need to reintroduce detention. But not only that, we need to reintroduce it in a very different way. Up to 1980, whenever immigrant detention was used, it was while the government decided whether an immigrant had the right to come in or not, or whether while the immigrant awaited deportation. Mm-hmm. After 1980, when President Reagan comes to power, he says, you know what, we're going to do something different. Now, we're not only going to reintroduce detention, but we're going to use it as a form of deterrence so that future migrants who are thinking about coming see how horrible it is to arrive here and never even set sail.
Of course, this is still more or less the world that we live in today, right? With our politicians saying, do not come, right? And things like that. I mean, it's sort of a horrible question to ask, but I am genuinely curious to hear your answer. Do you think that form of deterrence works? And is the cruelty of the system part of what does make it work, if you think it does?
I don't want to say that this is the tragedy of it all, because I think the tragedy of it all is how terrible immigrants are being treated. But actually, it is not an effective policy. It's not even like we can say this is an effective policy. Both our history and our present have shown this. In the period between 1954 to 1980, the government turned away from immigrant detention, knowing that the vast number of immigrants who were released and had to appear in immigration court did so, and that it wasn't working. At the same time, deterrence doesn't work nowadays. Let's think about it. The Trump administration. Trump introduced one of the most brutal detention practices and deterrence practices, which was the policy of family separation, that when parents arrived with their children, the children would be taken and detained separately from their parents. A horrible, horrible thing. You would think Central Americans will stop coming after this. It's so inhumane. Why would they come? But the reality is that the conditions in their home countries were so much worse that they kept coming. A year after President Trump introduced the family separation policy, there were 88% more apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border, meaning more people were coming.
I mean, I guess if I'm following the line of thinking of the deterrence advocates, they think like, well, it must work a little bit. Like, we can imagine a world where the U.S. allows absolutely everybody in, or, you know, allows the border to be quote-unquote open. And we can imagine a world where the U.S. stops literally everyone from coming in. And it feels like those two worlds, there would be a different amount of migration to the United States, though, right? So, I mean, I guess part of my question is, do we think that the immigration policy of the United States doesn't have an effect on who comes or how often people come, you know, understanding that that may be the case because the conditions in, say, Central America or in Haiti right now are so brutal that it's just our policy gets swamped by the domestic situation in these other countries.
Immigration policy does play a bit of a role, but I think the conditions in people's home countries are so dire that they keep coming. Giving it a try is worth it when your life is at risk. And not only that, not only at risk, like slightly at risk, you know, you are in terrible danger.
They already killed your child.
Exactly.
And they're going to.
So, of course, you flee. Giving it a try is worth it.
You know, can you tell that story about one of the characters in your book who, you know, is under active threat from gangs? And, yeah, their options are essentially wait for their family to be murdered or leave.
Yeah, so that's the case of Fernando Arredondo. Fernando lived with his wife and children right outside Guatemala City. And he was trying to protect his neighborhood. He had created a neighborhood watch program to protect himself and his family and his community from gangs. Because of that, the gangs retaliated against him. They killed his son in front of his wife, in front of his two daughters. And then they started to threaten the whole family and went after them. It was very clear that they would all be killed soon. And so Fernando fled with his three daughters, arrived to the United States, asked for asylum. And I have to say, we're talking about deterrence as if immigrant detention, as if immigrant policy in general doesn't abide by certain rules. But in fact, the right to asylum is not only internationally permitted, but the United States says that it's legal to apply for asylum.
By coming to the border.
Absolutely. And that's what Fernando did. He arrived with one of his daughters to the Laredo processing station, asked for asylum, and he was separated from Andrea, who was only 12 at the time. Andrea was sent to a tender age facility, and Fernando was detained for months in for-profit prisons, detention centers that were run by for-profit prison companies.
When you find people, you know, in these impossible, impossible situations, and I just want to note for folks as you're telling one person's story, that that one person's story is sitting on a pile of research that you did with other folks too, right, who found themselves in similar impossible situations.
That's right. The goal was to tell the story through four people, but that story reveals the story, the broad transformations of the immigrant detention system and the experience of thousands and thousands of people who have been detained and have experienced, you know, what it means to leave their home countries, to arrive in the United States only to be caged, and how their lives develop afterwards.
We're talking with Stanford history professor Ana Raquel Miñan about her book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States, a fascinating and I think unanticipated account of how this particular form of incarceration took hold in the United States and continues to shape many, many thousands of immigrants' lives. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to get to more of your calls and comments after the break. Have you or a loved one had experience in the immigration detention system, or maybe your work as a lawyer or an advocate has brought you into contact with it? We'd love to hear from you. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or maybe you want to email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We'll be back with more right after the break. Coming up in the next hour of Forum with Mina Kim, we speak to biologist Tessa Roseboom about her research on the long-term health impacts of starvation. In the final months of World War II, people living in Amsterdam suffered severe food deprivation due to a German blockade. Roseboom studied the long-term effects on the Dutch survivors that lived through it and their descendants 50 years later. Her research has sobering relevance for those living through war today. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Stanford history professor Ana Raquel Mignon about her new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. Let's bring on Michael in San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to hear your story. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, back in 1982, I heard about these Cubans in McNeil Island prison. They had come over as Marielistas and were, I was an attorney at the time, and I was in Seattle, so I decided to find help for them. Mm-hmm. It turned out that a lot of them were, they had dark skin and tattoos, mm-hmm. and were criminals, and about, I don't know, 10% of the Marielistas were sent to prison. I represented about 300 on McNeil Island in a federal prison.
Wow. What did that experience teach you about the system, this immigrant detention system?
Well, it appeared to be me very racist and driven by, kind of racial philosophy. Mm. The darker the person, the more tattoos they had, the more they were considered criminal types. Hmm. When they came over in the Mario boat lift. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael, let me bring that to Ana Raquel. I mean, I think you found that both within the Cuban population, but also between different Caribbean populations too, with Haitians being treated differently as well. Thank you so much for that call, Michael. And the kind of racialization of who is detained, how they're detained, who's considered a worthy admit to the United States.
That's right. First, I want to respond about the tattoos. Yes, it's absolutely right. And tattoos in Cuba didn't signify being part of a gang or being a criminal. It was just interpreted very differently. So it's interesting that in the United States, as soon as they arrived, having a tattoo became the symbol of criminality. Mm-hmm. And yes, race mattered. And the way we can see it the most is not just with Black or Cubans, but with Haitians, as you said. Haitians were arriving at the same time as folks from Mariel. Those who were detained, the Haitians who were detained in much worse conditions. Most Mariel Cubans were eventually admitted into the United States. The vast majority of Haitians were deported to Haiti. So they were treated much worse once they were here, and then they were deported.
Part of that Haitian history as well involves another piece that the book really reveals, which is Guantanamo, right?
Yeah, the story of Guantanamo is fascinating. So we generally understand Guantanamo as this place where George W. Bush used to hold quote unquote terrorists.
Unlawful enemy combatants.
That's right. That is the correct term. Who, you know, and to hold them without basic rights. But in fact, his father, George H.W. Bush, was the first person to use Guantanamo as a place to hold people without rights. And those people were Haitian refugees. In fact, Guantanamo Base in Cuba was first used as an immigrant detention center, where the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, used to hold Haitians without basic constitutional rights.
And it's obviously a little different how the people were held, though, right? I mean, it wasn't a Haitian torture facility. It was just being used at that point as like a detention center.
That's correct. It was used as a detention center where people did not have rights to a hearing or to anything else. Right. Eventually, it actually became the first HIV sort of carceral space because only HIV Haitians were being held there. What happened was most Haitians were either allowed into the United States or, in fact, deported back to Haiti because they were discovered or claimed not to have proper asylum claims. But there was a group of people whom the government decided, yes, if they go back to Haiti, they'll definitely be killed, but they won't be allowed here because won't be allowed into the United States because they're HIV positive. So they just kept them in Haiti. And I have to say, it's true. Haiti was not conceived as a place to torture people.
Get Guantanamo.
Guantanamo was not thought of as a place to torture people. And yet the conditions there often can only be described as torture. People were often hit during protests, were not being released, were not being given, were not being told what their medical care was. They were often given medical care under pretense, under lies, under coercion. Mm-hmm. So yes, it was not conceived as a place of terror, but it did act as one.
Yeah. And then it was waiting there to be repurposed in this later time period. Let's bring in another call. Let's bring in Molly in San Francisco. Welcome, Molly.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
My question is, I'm a teacher on the peninsula in a high school who receives immigrant students. And a couple of years ago, I did a survey. 29 out of 30 students had been held in the cages. Mm. And I want to know what they're underage. I want to know what the international response to this treatment of children is, as well as the U.S. government.
Go ahead, Anna.
Yeah, so in the U.S., we know that detaining children, psychologists say that it amounts to torture, and yet the government continues to do so. There is also a lot of international pressure not to do so, but really, there has not been that much attention. This is what's highly sad, is we have only focused on immigrant detention when President Trump started to separate children from their parents. But the reality is that children are being detained on a regular basis, and they have been for a very, very long time, much earlier than the Trump administration. In fact, it starts in 1891. Mm-hmm. So it is legal. Nowadays, there's the Florida settlement that says families need to be released after a certain period of time if they have children, et cetera. But it's often not abided by. So it's so people are still, like you said, children are being detained.
Mm. What do you want to happen? Like, how do you imagine that this could be reformed, this system, or abolished, or like how do you think about this immigrant detention complex, and if you could just say, okay, here's how we're going to deal with X number of people who are coming to the border and asking for asylum or some other way at the border?
Well, without a doubt, the United States needs to change its broader immigration laws and policies, and without that there won't be real change. But with the current political situation, I don't expect a broad immigration reform to happen. But I do think we could change our detention system. Like I said, from 1954 to 1980, the government moved away from detaining immigrants to releasing them on parole. And we can do so again. We know the reason why many Americans fear releasing immigrants instead of detaining them is because of this idea that, well, if we release them, they won't appear to their immigration court. And then if they need to be deported, they won't be. But this is actually a fallacy. Over 88% of all immigrants who need to appear in immigration court do so. And the number rises to 98% for those who have a lawyer or for asylum seekers. So we don't actually need to be detaining people. We can release them on parole. It would save us a lot of money. It would save us from building a country based on inhumane practices, unethical practices, one in which our democracy is being eroded through ideas such as some people don't deserve constitutional rights. So if I were to advocate for something, it's, at the moment, it's only to return to the system of parole, of releasing immigrants instead of holding them in cages while we are adjudicating their cases. Yeah.
I mean, I guess the counter argument is, you know, what about the 2% or what about the 10% multiplied by several hundreds of thousands, right? I mean, is there, what about these other sort of solutions that I can imagine some, you know, moderate policymaker might come to you and say, well, okay, well, we'll release people, but we'll release them under, you know, intense digital surveillance.
These alternative to detention methods, I think, are highly problematic. We have the same with alternative to incarceration, which, and they're problematic because they consist of things that actually ruin the possibilities of migrants leading a successful life. So even if they're going to be accepted in the country later, we've kind of ruined their possibilities. Let's think, for example, of ankle bracelets. Ankle bracelets is one of the forms in which we try to control migrants to ensure that they don't escape. But if someone has an ankle bracelet, they can't. It's very hard for them to find a job or to get a job. People don't really want to hire someone who has an ankle bracelet. Mm-hmm. It's hard for them to become part of their community, to make friends. And if we think about this, these are all the ways in which we help people not commit crimes. So it actually incentivizes exactly what we don't want to incentivize: people without a community, people without a job. Mm. These policies don't work. And in fact, what's really interesting about them is that the companies who create these bracelets, these electronic monitors, etc., are actually the same companies, the same for-profit companies that run for-profit prisons. So now that we're moving away from prisons, from detention centers, and we're moving towards this, it's the same companies that are receiving profits. It's just another way to cage people, just not behind bars.
You know, one listener wanted to hear more about, they said, you know, can you talk more about the for-profit incentives to have detention centers open? Why are we spending so much of our tax dollars on detention instead of spending more money on processing asylum claims? Is there enough funding for the asylum seekers and processing legitimate immigration cases?
We're spending so much money on detaining immigrants. That's absolutely true. In 2018, for example, when President Trump started the separation policy, we spent $3 billion on it. That same year, the EPA spent about $8.8 billion. So instead of using that money to detain immigrants who, for the most part, who really don't need to be detained, let me say this, we could be using it in improving water quality, the health of our population, and yes, in adjudicating the claims of asylum seekers. There is no reason for us not to use this money in better ways that actually help American society.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit, too, about the intersection of these for-profit companies? Like, they have been in immigrant detention from... Well, the very beginning, really, 1891, the steamship companies were running a private prison, essentially. But more specifically, after 1980, during this time of the, like, Mario, you know, Cuban refugees, and they have been in building the system from the very beginning.
Yeah, so after 1980, there's this huge concern about immigrants. We don't want to repeat the Mario boat lift. We need to incarcerate more and more immigrants. And at the same time, we need to incarcerate more and more people because of the war on drugs. So the Reagan administration was increasing the number of people it was holding in prisons dramatically, both detained immigrants and people who were being caught under the war on drugs. So the Attorney General decided we need to build more prisons. We absolutely need more prisons. And one man approached him, Tom Beasley, in a party, came up with the idea that, well, you know what would be a great solution? For-profit companies, for-profit prisons. So he approached the Attorney General, and the Attorney General said, yes, this is a great solution. The government doesn't have to invest money in building more prisons. It doesn't have to run the prisons. So in 1983, this idea that immigrant detention, that prisons could be run for profit, built for profit, and that every single aspect of incarceration would be run by a company for profit developed. And what's really interesting about these for-profit prisons is that the Attorney General was a little bit concerned. Well, how are they going to run them? So there was a solution. Let's place in the first for-profit prison people who are, you know, less risky, immigrant detainees. The first for-profit prison in the United States, for-profit prison in the United States, was a detention center.
Who was held there?
Immigrant detainees.
Yeah. No, but not a particular, just like all immigrants.
Often Mexicans, but yeah, a lot of different immigrants, yeah.
Let's go to this call. Joyce Lupak in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. I work at Legal Services for Children. We're a local nonprofit based in San Francisco, and we serve the youth who have been detained in the Northern California immigration centers. We go to the centers and do Know Your Rights for them. And then we represent them if they have a case, say asylum, if they're released locally. And so, yeah, these kids are traumatized. We have a staff of attorneys and social workers. And I wanted to note that the where the youth are coming from has gotten much more diverse over the last few years. We serve in any language that we meet within the centers. And we used to serve about 22 different languages a year, and now it's gone up to about 30. So kids are coming from all over the world and being detained here, released here locally, and we're doing our best to address their trauma and their legal needs. Mm. And it's really challenging and painful. The stories are really hard.
Have you noticed differences, you know, between what was happening under the Trump administration and what was happening during the Biden administration?
Oh, that's a great question. The need is really consistent, and I think that the rights that the youth had were squeezed more under Trump, but their rights are never, the kids are always being, you know, traumatized by the mm-hmm. system, right? So, yeah. I could say, yeah, in some ways it's more ferocious, but there's also this really ongoing need, no matter mm-hmm. kind of who's in office, so.
Hey, Joyce, thank you so much for that work, taking care of the kids. Really appreciate it, and thank you for that call. I think returning to the current policy environment, things aren't good, and I think many immigrant advocates that I've spoken with over the years have said, you know, they're kind of disappointed in the Biden administration. You look ahead to the next presidential administration, whether, let's say it's Donald Trump, could things get worse, or are we already at kind of like a low?
Things could get much, much worse. Trump has already said that he would dramatically expand our detention system and deport and would try to expand our deportation campaign to deport millions of immigrants. I think things can get much worse. There's a lot of fear of immigrants, unwarranted fear, I have to say, of immigrants. Like the previous caller, thank you so much for your work, said, the Biden administration has done terrible work in protecting children and protecting immigrants in general. Mm-hmm. And yet, compared to another possible Trump administration, I would say I personally fear much more for immigrants what would happen under a Trump administration.
We've been talking with Ana Raquel Miñan, Associate Professor of History at Stanford. Her new book is In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. If you're interested in the history of immigration as well as in the growth of the carceral state, this is the book you want to check out. Thank you so much for joining us here this morning, Ana Raquel.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful.
Yeah. Again, the book is In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim. We'll be right back.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation,